Hello and welcome to the DexEU's Midnight Runner edition of Romaniacs, the Large Hadron Collider of Brexit podcasts, where we send all the information about Britain's departure from the EU spinning around at fantastic speeds. I'm Dorian Linsky and I'm back from my holiday in France, where I somehow avoided the four-hour border hell that the Daily Mail claims the EU has imposed as an ironic punishment for Brexit. Maybe the passport gendarmes gave me special Romaniacs treatment. And joining me as usual is the editor of politics.co.uk, Ian Dunt, who has also been away. Oh, Ian, where did you go?
I went to Italy. It was absolutely terrible, as you can imagine. There was lots of really lovely wine, very good meat, very lovely cheese, and lots of sunshine. So I had a dreadful time.
Good job we're getting out of that Europe, isn't it?
Yes, it's about time that we did that, really. I'd really prefer some more obstacles between me and that particular location.
The only problem I made on holiday was occasionally checking my phone for some other purpose.
Ah, you see, and I refused to check it at all. So I switched off my internet and just basically wouldn't touch that thing except to take photos, which was a problem because that was how we were working out our little bits of expenditure. So my friends could have rather screwed me there. But nevertheless, the best option was just not to have any contact.
I literally, at one point, was looking at my phone and grimacing, and my daughter said, "What's up, Dad? Is it Brexit again?" which is a true story. And I just logged onto Twitter for some other benign reason and ended up having an argument with Labour Leave.
Oh, no.
Like a sort of red UKIP. And I was like, why am I doing this? Why am I so cross? And then I just sort of made myself enjoy Europe and food and sunshine and stuff.
Yeah. Like, partly, you don't want to fight because you don't want to bring up all of that sort of negative emotional stuff during a holiday. You want to de-stress. But also, because I'm running the website a lot of the time, if I see a news line, I can't help but start repackaging it in my head and thinking, like, where are the various avenues that can go? And then that work brain bit just gets switched back on, and I really, really need that work brain bit to be switched off when I'm on holiday. So basically the phone just needs to go in the corner and just not be touched as much as possible.
And also with us is Peter Collins, formerly business editor of The Economist, now the armchair Indiana Jones of Brexitography. How's your work brain, Peter?
It's ticking along, just about, yes.
It's on full blast. You did a splendid job of presenting the show last week with Naomi Smith. Did we miss anything terrifying on our holidays?
Well, there was one thing. This briefly employed White House Chief of Staff, Anthony Scaramucci. While he was briefly in his job, he made us all throw up all of our dinners forever by searing indelibly into our brains the gruesome image of Steve Bannon committing what many newspapers delicately described as autofellatio.
Very good.
Which sounds more like sucking off a Ford Mondeo's exhaust pipe. Terrifying, anyway.
You'll be pleased to hear that news of the mooch travelled far and wide across the European Union. And one of the highlights of my holiday is his sort of breakneck tenure. And we are very excited to welcome back to Romaniacs Roz Taylor. She's the editor of democraticaudit.com and the managing editor of LSE Brexit Blogs, which is a fantastic deep dive into Brexit. Welcome back, Roz. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm just about to enjoy my holiday in the EU.
We're ticking them all off. We've done France, we've done Italy.
Then I'm going to be boring and say France again. Brittany.
France again.
Yeah.
Right, so Peter, when you go on holiday to Europe, you're going to have to choose something more.
The Falkland Islands, of course.
Proper British destination. So, Russ, for listeners who don't know, can you explain what LSE Blogs is all about?
Yeah, LSE Blogs is the whole series of blogs belonging to London School of Economics. And we have loads of them about things like religion in the public sphere and European politics and all kinds of stuff. But the one I co-edit is the LSE Brexit blog, which we started about 18 months ago now, nearly 2 years, not expecting it to last beyond 2016. And here we are, having just got another 2 years funding. So swings and roundabouts, eh?
So it's good news as well, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly.
So what have you uncovered about Brexit since you started the blogs? Have there been any kind of exciting
news? We've done a lot on particularly EU migrants, because my co-editor is actually Polish, Rochdin Vanzovich. There you go, he's got his name check there. And he's actually got permanent residency now, which he fought very hard to get earlier this year. But he's Polish. So we've got a special interest in EU migrants in the UK. And we've looked in particular at some of the problems they have with all the paperwork, with all the admin and all the uncertainty still over a year after we've voted to leave.
Which he's about to go through again, right? Because his permanent residency will be stripped from him when they introduce the new system, and he'll be forced to reapply for the settled status or whatever.
Yeah.
So that 84-page form he had to fill out, I guess, was for absolutely no reason whatsoever. And he's going to become an expert in exactly what bureaucracy entails in your own personal life as well as his professional life.
Yes, yes. I mean, it gave him a short-term feeling of brief respite, and then it was all thrown into disarray again. But that means that we do a lot, in particular, on EU migrants, and we're doing a big... He's coordinating a big survey at the moment called Generation Brexit, which is aimed at asking what under-30s, under-35s think about Brexit.
Well, there's one particular LSE Blogs item we're going to be talking about later. Which regions will suffer most and least from Brexit? So hold tight, find out whether it's the sunny uplands of sovereignty for you or a life of sprout picking for three shiny new British shillings per hour. Of course, we'll be rounding up the latest developments from Planet Brexit, and we'll also be answering your Brexit questions in the first of what might be a regular feature, unless we make an utter David Davis of it, called Ask Romaniacs. Before we get started, can we ask a favour? If you've been enjoying the show and you use an Apple device, then why not subscribe to Romaniacs via Apple Podcasts on your phone or iTunes on your computer? Every episode of Romaniacs will then materialise on your phone or other device of its own accord. And if you have a second, leave us a nice positive review on iTunes too. Subscriptions and reviews help us get noticed on Apple Podcasts and generally spread the word about Romaniacs. Android people, that includes people who are Androids as well as people who use it, do not despair. We're on Pocket Cast, Stitcher, Overcast and Spotify too, and now Acast as well. You can find links to all of those things at the mothership, romaniacs.com. And before we start the news roundup, just a little note for your diaries. If things proceed in their current direction, Britain will leave the EU on 29th of March 2019. We're not giving in to the madder kind of Brexiteer and calling it Independence Day, and Brexit Day is far too depressing a name. So henceforth, we will refer to it as B-Day. Because it's going to give us a very strange and un-British feeling and a fundamental sense of unease. Let's start the news with a remarkable YouGov poll into Brexit extremism from earlier this week. Among other things, it found that 61% of Leave voters would accept significant damage to the British economy as a price worth paying for Brexit. When they were asked would it be worth you or members of your family losing their jobs, 39% said it would still be worth it. I understand the 22% who think an economic disaster is okay as long as they personally don't suffer, more than the 39% who will sabotage their own kids for a blue passport. The polling also found that in both cases, general economic misery and misery for me and my family, the figures went up the older the Leave voters were. The New Statesman reported it as, "This research on Brexit proves that baby boomers hate their own children." But there was also some evidence of extremism on the Remain side. 34% of Remain voters would accept serious damage to the economy if it meant staying inside the EU. 38% wouldn't, and 18% of Remainers would accept losing their job or someone in their family losing their job in order to stay in the EU. Ian, what does this all mean?
I mean, really horrible things. I can't even really, you know, the instinct is to think, well, to start reappraising how we think of like economic arguments and do you win the debate on that. I didn't really have any of that when I saw this stuff. I actually thought this was one of the most sort of shocking polls I'd seen in a really long time, and I was quite... I mean, not upset by it exactly, but just this idea that you basically got, I think, was it half the people, leavers over 65, I think, were basically saying that they'll be willing for someone that they knew, for a friend or family member, to lose their job over this stuff. And you just think, like, what happened in your life that you just got to this point that you're actually going to tick that box and say, you know, I'm perfectly comfortable with, like, my brother losing his job as long as it gets me my crazed ideological, you know, outcome. I found it quite troubling.
Well, the thing that people always used to say about racists, not that all Leave voters are racists, obviously.
Heavens no.
Few are, was that, well, but they love their family. So they don't love anyone else, but they love their grandkids and they want what's best for them.
It's
and
if the Grey Twins argument,
if that
isn't
means,
it?
Yeah, if
nice
that means
mother.
Racism or knocking people off in the Grey Twins case, you know, well, so be it. But that was one thing you could say about them. And these guys, they're just like, literally, no, I will take racism above my grandkids' prospects.
Oh, they don't know what they're actually saying. What they're actually saying is, I know what's good for you. And, you know, that's what older generations do. I've started doing it with my kids, you know. I've made them do stuff they don't want to do because I know it's good for them. And sometimes I'm probably wrong. And the older I get, the more often I'm probably likely to be wrong. And that's where they're going.
Can I put in a counter-argument, just for the sake of the debate? So I'm a Remainer who voted Remain not for economic reasons. I didn't believe any of the stuff on either side. I voted for the European project. No wars among European nations, cooperation on everything from safety regulation to conservation, a continent full of civil liberties, freedom to travel and work, all that sort of thing. I personally think I would sacrifice a few GDP points for this. And if, therefore, to be intellectually honest, I would say, yes, I suppose that, you know, if we sacrifice a couple of points of GDP in order to do this, then people may lose their jobs. You know, people I know might may lose their jobs. You'd be intellectually dishonest to say otherwise. And if you look at right, if, just forgetting Brexit for a moment, if you look at all areas of economic policy, there's all sorts of things that chip off a few points of GDP. If businesses were completely free to rip off little old ladies and stuff like that, and we didn't care about civil rights and equality and all those sorts of things, the economy actually might well be more efficient, and we might actually get those extra points of GDP. So, you know, we don't just do things, thankfully, to maximise GDP growth or however you measure the economy, and we don't even do things to maximise employment. So
the thing that gets me, I suppose, is when you say GDP, yes, we know that that involves jobs somewhere. But what you can start doing is saying to yourself, well, it'll be this kind of job over there. It'll be the kind of job that I don't approve of. You know, it'll be a banker or something like that. When you start saying, I'm actually willing to see the people that I love lose their job, that's a really different thing. I mean, it's really quite hard for me to think of many political virtues that I'd put above the people around me being able to make enough money and having a happy life. And that seems to suggest it's not so much sort of like a political issue, but just something fundamentally like emotional and psychological, like a switch going where your sense of priorities becomes hopelessly misplaced. That's the bit that starts to trouble me. But I do also think, you know, you were right to point out that stuff with the Remainers. And I see quite a lot of this with Remainer people online as sort of almost like a wishing, and Peter, you've always been very good on sort of slapping this stuff down when it comes to, but almost like a wishing for the British economy to be bashed around a little bit in order for us to, you know, show that we were right. And there's always, again, another psychological, emotional moment of when you start slipping into tribalism to not allow yourself to prioritise being right over sort of the best interests of the country.
Yeah, you've got to bear in mind this is people saying stuff, and you know it's very different from it actually getting there. And they want to defend their decision. You know, we all made a decision. We want to show it's the right one.
I always wonder whether some of them felt that this was almost like a trick question. It's just like, well, you think you were right, but what if your like daughter lost her job? And they just think, you can't get me there. I don't care. I still don't care. I still don't regret it. You know.
Yeah.
Whereas if you literally had like their daughter sad in front of them crying, Dad, why did you lose me my job? Then it might be different. Maybe not. Maybe some of them are just psychopaths.
Moving on.
Moving on. Let's move on to the brief regency of Chancellor Philip Hammond, or as Matthew Paris dubbed him in his Britain is Banana Republic analogy, Don Felipe. Hammond has had the control column of government since Theresa May went on holiday to Switzerland a week ago. And while Theresa's away, the Hammond will play. He raised the idea of a transitional implementation phase on the single market for 2 years after Brexit, which is a red rag to the hard Brexit crew. That would take us up to the next scheduled general election in 2022. This has caused terrible confusion as to what the government's position really is. Plus ça change. With different ministers floating different solutions. And Hammond's stand-in turn running the government has not gone down well with the Brexiteers. One unnamed cabinet colleague told The Guardian he needs to put a sock in it, stop undermining the boss and get on with his day job. They said he was guilty of crazy behaviour. And Colonel Bufton Tufton in The Telegraph wrote in, "For more than a year, I have considered Philip Hammond a fifth columnist for Brussels. His treachery to the cabinet and the country over the last few days is the final straw. I would hope that Theresa May sees fit to show him the door. Sorry, P.S. I would love a coup."
Was that his real name? Is that all made up?
That's just like generic Telegraph letter writer name,
isn't
it?
Oh, I see. Right,
Colonel Bufton Tufton, yes.
Probably.
Apologies to any real Colonel Bufton Tufton who are keeping the nation safe.
There's probably a whole office in the Telegraph churning out this stuff, you realise. It may not actually be genuine.
using fridge magnets, treachery, fifth columnist, Brussels paymasters. Ian, how is Don Felipe's tenure going?
It's hard to tell, really. He's clearly positioned himself as the guy that's going to be reasonable about all of this stuff. His positions are still not particularly moderate. I mean, he's still talking about being outside of the customs union, outside of the single market, but on a more realistic timescale. Although it's important to note that his timescale is dictated entirely by the British electoral cycle. That's why he's talking about this 2-3 year thing. Not because that's what business says, not because that's how long these kind of negotiations usually take. So even, you know, the fact that we've got to a stage where he is considered the sane one, just because he looks, you know, like a sort of ragged pair of curtains, doesn't really change anything. I mean, he is still putting forward a quite mad point of view, just slightly less mad than the people around him. Downing Street then come out. They basically said transition's fine. Remember, Theresa May used to rebrand it as the implementation phase, although, you know, casually forgetting stuff that nothing would have been agreed by then, so there's nothing to implement. So they're going to accept a transition, but they won't accept what he's talking about, which is an out-the-box transition, off-the-shelf transition, which would suggest some sort of EEA membership. He's doing his best, really. But the thing is, there is no authority anywhere. So it doesn't really matter what anyone around the cabinet table says, because there's no real prime minister except for this cardboard box that we've got, who's now walking in Switzerland. So you don't really know what's really going to happen. It's just people fighting one another and struggling for control. So you can hear this stuff and you think, well, fine, that's of passing interest. But it doesn't really tell you anything about our future direction of travel.
There's also an element of making the most of where the situation they're stuck in. So the other interesting thing, very important thing, I think, that Hammond said in the past few days was basically giving this interview to a French newspaper saying, look, we are not going to become this low tax regulation country. He didn't use the phrase Singapore on Thames, but that's the one that's been used. And he said, you know, after Brexit, Britain will still be recognisably European. Now, he said that exactly the opposite at the beginning of the year to a German newspaper, that we could do all this, you know.
He does keep talking to the Europeans, doesn't he?
Exactly.
Suspicious.
But there's two things. One is that, obviously, a Singapore on Thames option with further spending cuts, further tax cuts, deregulation, wouldn't get through Parliament now because they don't have the majority. It would be, you know, impossible to do. So that's just basically facing up to reality. So while he's doing that, he may as well make the most of it by positioning it as an overture to the EU side, to say into a French newspaper so that it gets read in Paris and Brussels and so on, look, you know, we're not going to do that. We're good Europeans still. We're going to be quite reasonable in these negotiations, even though it's driven essentially by the fact that they can't actually do that at the moment.
Yeah, and I mean, that is interesting that he's at least making those overtures. And you see him positioning himself with the Europeans as, look, I've been the reasonable one, you know, if by any chance he might be able to get to take over at some time in the future, which I don't think is outside of the realm's possibility. If I had to put money on someone replacing May, I'd probably go with him, in terms of it would suggest a change of the winds. The winds would probably be blowing in that direction. And he's still ultimately this sort of, you know, quite tedious figure. And that can often, at moments of sort of volatile political change, be quite a good quality for someone to have.
John Major, anyone?
Well, exactly, yeah. And that worked out terribly well.
Well, hang on a
second.
He
did last for 7 years.
Everybody wanted John Major because they wanted somebody who was more consensual and collegial. I thought he was good, actually. I voted for him. I think it was great. Of course, it was a parliament full of cock-ups, but that was the Eurosceptics to blame, in my view. Anyway, we're getting a bit off topic.
You could sort of say that he created that by you know, going for the whole, like, you know, family values sort of attitude.
I can't help myself but go a bit off topic.
But I'm actually quite fond of John Major, so you're right.
Back in those days, we used to care about Cohn's hotlines. Do you remember? That was what politics was like about.
What days?
Yeah. I think the important thing is that John Major was terrible. Moving on. Now, the music community has finally responded to the threat of Brexit. Who is speaking for the young people whose futures have been thrown into disarray? Is it the angry youth with their fierce opposition to neoliberalism? No, it's 74-year-old squillionaire Sir Mick Jagger with his new double A-side single Gotta Get a Grip and England Lost. Let's hear a bit of it. Now, we know things are bad when Mick has to write a protest song. In 1968, he wrote Street Fighting Man, a song about why he wasn't actually a street fighting man. In 1983, Undercover of the Night was perhaps the only good thing to come out of Reagan supporting fascist junters in Central America. 4 years ago, there was Doom and Gloom, which attacked the Iraq War for being a waste of money. Now, Brexit has turned the butterfly on a wheel into an enemy of the people and forced him to sound like Black Grape fronted by a Mick Jagger impersonator from the News Quiz. What do we think?
A steaming pile of festering turds is my considered view.
I don't really work with political music, to be honest, whether I agree with it or don't, and I usually do, because typically speaking, political music's on the left and, you know, and this sort of stuff. But I just always find it so sort of painful to listen to. Even, you know, you take Billy Bragg or something, this classic stuff, where the lyrics of the political songs are actually very good and very well thought through. I still really quite dislike them and find them a bit sort of finger-wagging. And then when he does the romance songs or just songs about life in general, I find his lyrics really genuinely quite beautiful and sort of sensitive and well thought through. I struggle outside of sort of Public Enemy and Rage Against the Machine, the sort of classic bands that will just do that stuff, to really think of any political songs I like. So I don't think I'm the person to ask this question of.
Yeah, it's always tough for an old rich bloke to pontificate on politics, isn't it? I mean, you know, we trust pop in politics when it comes out of the grassroots. It's much more difficult when it comes from someone who is, you know, very rich, very secure, big stadium rock. You know, it's not a man. He's no longer a man of the people. That's the problem.
This has been some of the most non-committal music criticism.
Well, yeah. Well, as someone who wrote, as you wrote a book about protest songs, I do like an awful lot of them. I don't think there's any reason why. I think it does come down to the song, not necessarily even the person, that you could do it well. And there are lines in here that I quite like, and lines in here which I very much don't. And what's weird is that actually Mick's bits are better than Skepta's. Because Skepta sort of rots up and he does this kind of real generic kind of protest. Ain't nothing changed. It's all the same. People in streets, people in suits. And it's like, well, things have changed. It's quite a big change, actually. Like, if you're going to criticise Brexit, you can't do the kind of same old kind of line. It just seems like very boilerplate. Whereas, you know, Mick playing, I don't keep calling him Mick, like he's my mate. Sir Mick Jagger. You know, he's got a football analogy. He's got a bit about how it's putting a cramp in his womanizing because he got a girl in Lisbon, a girl in Rome, now got to stay at home. So that's sad for them.
That is. It's a pretty good argument for Brexit, though.
I think that actually they...
leave those poor women alone.
They're going to be looking forward to some tighter border controls. But I liked the fact that he was sort of making an effort because it's still quite early days, you know, that obviously, you can write a protest song very, very quickly, but a lot of the time it takes a while to filter through. People take a while to make an album. So you're seeing facets of it in Gorillaz, Maximo Park. It's sort of coming out. But for him to just sort of go straight out, like, I'm going to write a kind of a very old-fashioned, not in its sound, well, kind of, but, you know, in its kind of conception, this protest song about how I don't like what's going on. And then listing some stuff. He does this bit where he's just obviously kind of listing like Twitter trending topics where he goes, oh, fake news. What's that about? Fake news.
I've just been handed a note by our producer, Andrew, who says, are you mixplaining?
I am. I feel like I need to defend him a little. Like sometimes there is a category of protest song where you just think, I'm glad that you bothered to make this. I don't want to hear it ever again. But that sort of impulse... I find sort of winningly eccentric from a man that does not need to do this.
Is this, I mean, I'm in danger of going into music criticism here, which is not an area that I'm going to be particularly strong on. But like, it just sort of seems to me that back when I was sort of growing up, you know, sort of in the late 90s and the early noughties, that ultimately most of the interesting things were happening in the indie scene and pop was pretty terrible. And now it seems that the indie scene is largely dead and pop is really quite interesting and all the people that have got stuff to say and interesting things to do musically seem to be going into there. That's obviously an industry that would be much more resistant towards coming out with political messages. And could it be that this sort of silence that we hear from the music community is to do with that?
I don't, just to sort of, you know, to wrap things up, I don't think that there's silence. Like on Brexit Day, you know, I saw bands at Glastonbury, a diverse range of people at Glastonbury, like the 1975 Bastille churches, making a very passionate statement. Now, whether you can turn that into a song, I think is the difficult thing. But the guy from Bastille has been talking about this loads. You can, if you open a music magazine now, Brexit and Trump are going to be in there. But can you write a good song about it? Mick Jagger suggests at the moment, no. So, you know, it's a challenge, but I don't think it's that they don't care. Now, Ian, this is a story you were especially keen to talk about. Romaniac's favourite and walking-talking Churchill insurance dog, David Davis, has recruited a new chief of staff, a chap called Stuart Jackson. This is the MP who called the Tory manifesto electoral poison after losing his seat in Peterborough at the election. So he's not a fan of Theresa May. But hang on, he also called a constituent a thick chav on Facebook when upset about losing his seat. So, Ian, who is this man? What does he want?
He's an odd one. He's interesting. There was the 12-month period after the referendum before the election. We're obviously on Twitter, you know, pretty much every day I'm just getting a barrage of abuse by sort of Brexit people. Really quite lowly stuff. And it took me ages to realise that he actually had the position that he had. Because he was one of them. And it was just the most bog-standard, suck-it-up whiner, you whining Remainer. It was really the lowest sort of rung of the sort of Brexiter abuse ladder. And he was actually literally one of them. And it was like, oh my God, you're actually part of the machinery. You're not just an MP. You're properly in the department. He I mean, he sent me, actually, halfway through the election, he sort of sent me a tweet where he was just like, it's going to be very hard for you crying into your cereal on the day that we win the election, isn't it? Which was, of course, a particularly wonderful moment for me when he then lost his seat on the
Monday. Did you send him a little message back?
Well, I tried to, but at that point, he promptly blocked me on Twitter, so there was no opportunity to do that.
You love to get over it.
Yeah, exactly. So there is something to learn, though, by the fact that he's in there now. He loses the job, voted out by his constituents, and is now brought in by David Davis as his chief of staff. Now, that tells us a few things. First of all, it tells us, has there been any sort of reassessment of how they're going about this and what they're trying to do? Quite evidently not, if this is the kind of guy they're bringing in. But also remember, he's supposed to be the go-between between Davis and the civil service. So the guys that are supposed to be coming up with obstacles that we need to correct, different ways of addressing these problems, are being faced with this guy, who's not even just a true believer, but is also an incredibly sort of angry, you know, emotionally broken true believer. That, again, sums into all the sort of stuff that we see again and again from Davis. Those trade groups that used to go see him in the early days would come out and say, look, we're being told by civil servants, before we go in, raise all the opportunities that are available by Brexit, downplay the problems, or else he's just going to ask you to leave after 5 minutes. And now we see him again surrounding himself by these very aggressive walls between himself and reality. And of course, we've now seen how that translates when he gets into Brussels. He doesn't have anything to say, can't even sit at those meetings, and instantly capitulates to what he's asked to do. So if it shows anything, it means that really nothing has changed in the actual guts of how Brexit operates, and we should ready ourselves for more of the exact same problems that we've seen so far.
Yeah, I mean, it's also about Davis's leadership ambitions. I'm pretty sure that he is lining himself up to do some, let's say, rousing stuff ahead of the Conservative Party conference, because we know how weak Theresa May is. She could go at any time. I don't think that Davis would at all object to becoming PM and being crowned PM, which undoubtedly, from the point of view of many in the current Conservative Party in Parliament, they'd be fairly happy with that. On the other hand, there are many people who seriously dislike him. He's a serial plotter. And I mean, you know, I remember going to Conservative Party conferences in the, 10, 15 years ago, and you would see Davis, and he would always be surrounded at Conservative Party conferences by this circle of admiring blokes. It's very much, you know, it's just completely straightforward. You know, he's a happily married man. It's just that he attracts a certain amount of hero worship among a certain amount of Conservatives. And I think that rehabilitating Stuart Jackson, and, you know, when he's sadly lost his seat, and bringing him back into politics, which I'm sure he's going to be very happy about, because he's an ally, is part of this getting ready to challenge Theresa May if necessary, and surrounding himself with, as you say, a shield of supporters. And that's what it's really about. And I also think it's a bit of a kind of Trump move in a way, because he wants to make sure there isn't too much leaking from DxEU. He wants to shore up, make sure the civil service behave themselves. This guy's going to be a bit of an enforcer.
Could there also be an element of Trumpism that, you know, Trump is having great difficulty filling all these posts, vacancies he keeps creating, and the ones he didn't fill in the first place, and you'd have to be a hardline, headbanging supporter to want to take it. Isn't there an element of that, you know, you wouldn't get Gavin Barwell, say, who became Theresa May's chief of staff, a Remainer, wanting to take the job, would you?
I don't know. I mean, at the beginning, I think that there was a lot of that immediately after the referendum, and you saw it with when, actually, Davis's department tried to bring people in, because unlike Liam Fox's one, which is sort of Frankenstein's monster, stitched together bits of the civil service, you know, the actual Brexit department was made out of nothing. And at the beginning, you had people that didn't want to be associated with it, weren't emotionally engaged, weren't intellectually engaged. But then later on, you sort of had that sense of, well, this is where the action is. This is the main thing. If you care about your country, if you care about how things are going to progress, this is the topic that you take a lead on. And I would have thought there were people who'd be uncomfortable with all of the social, emotional and political requirements of it that would still want the job because it's such a crucial role right now. The fact that he chose this guy, you know, I just think speaks volumes as to where we're going.
Well, we'll be adding Stuart's face to the wall of mugshots, Romaniacs HQ. Okay, you heard her earlier on. It's the marvellous Ros Taylor of LSE Brexit Blogs. And there's an especially interesting piece here this week, headlined "Which British Regions Will Suffer Most and Least from Brexit?" by Henry G. Overman. It's based on a survey by the LSE Centre for Economic Performance, working with the Centre for Cities think tank. In some respects, this is the big issue of Brexit. Which areas are the winners and losers? Unless we're all losers. And it's the guilty thought of all Remainers. When are all those people who voted to leave going to get their comeuppance? But it is an unworthy thought, because, of course, we want all parts of the country to prosper. Roz, tell us about this story.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, this, because I'm afraid, you know, everyone does suffer. There's no upside, really, in terms of regions. But this is all based on looking at the impact on different industries that Brexit will have on a soft Brexit and on a hard Brexit, a hard Brexit and a soft Brexit. So some industries under this model do really well post-Brexit. And fish, for example, agriculture, wood, paper, places that do that kind of thing will get off relatively lightly. On the other hand, if you work in financial services, if you work in mining, if you're involved in making electronic equipment, if you make chemicals, those are going to be worst affected. So that's what this is all based on. And what it shows is that the area worst affected is the City of London. You probably guess that. It's always been an outlier. After that, it's Aberdeen, then Tower Hamlets, Watford, places like Islington, Jeremy Corbyn's constituency, as it happens, that will be very hard hit by Brexit. A lot of places in the south, because they depend on industries which are very tapped into Europe, essentially. On the other hand, the places that won't be so much affected, are places like South Holland, which is in around the Wash, around Lincolnshire, North Lincolnshire, Moray, Crawley, the Isles of Scilly. Is going to get off relatively lightly, and Hounslow, because it's next to Heathrow, which should still be okay. So the interesting thing there is that what you're seeing, and this is going to be a disappointment to Remainers who want to see leavers suffer a bit, is that in the short term, it's going to be the leave voting areas, some of them, that do relatively well. I mean, not well, but less badly. That's probably better.
So what happened to that? Because there was an argument that I was very persuaded by, that various reasons that farmers who had voted for Brexit were going to kind of shot themselves in the foot, because there were all these sort of subsidies they were going to lose. I think he's to blame. So is this not the case when you talk about, so the farmers and the fishermen who voted leave, were they right?
This is the short term, and you've got to remember that all the subsidies are still in place in the short term, because the government has promised them up to 2022 in some cases. And so we're talking about the short term. Now, what the authors of this study at the LSE make clear is that this is only the short term. In the long term, there will be changes, there will be restructuring. The other thing to bear in mind is that they think that people affected in Remain areas like Islington and Tower Hamlets and so on, because they're more mobile, because they're more flexible, and because they tend to earn more, and the City of London especially, will be able to bounce back and they will be able to recover better. They're in a better position to start with. People in these poorer Remain voting areas have they have less ability to move around. They have less choice, fewer skills. They aren't going to be able to necessarily move out of a difficult situation as quickly.
And that the people who wrote the study, being proper academics, proper experts, who we like, go out of their way to say, look, this is just a study, as you say, of the first order trade effects. You know, if we suddenly get trade barriers, tariff barriers, non-tariff barriers, either hard or soft, this is what could happen. And they acknowledge that, you know, it's not a dynamic thing. They don't look at what happens when companies adjust. Of course, they don't look at what happens as a result of the pound falling. You know, the pound is weak at the moment, particularly against the euro. The euro, European economy is improving and so on. And also, we will eventually have to do some trade deals, these wonderful trade deals with big emerging markets, with the United States and so on. These are all, as far as I can see, very large agricultural exporters. So those farmers shouldn't be getting too relaxed about the short-term effects that are described here, because all the long-term stuff sounds quite bad.
I mean, certainly long-term, it's hard to see how agriculture survives in any capacity outside of really sort of poultry farming and maybe cereals, I would say. But even in the short term, I'm surprised it's okay, because, of course, the tariffs on agricultural goods are shockingly high. So if those barriers suddenly come up, you face a pretty tough time, even with subsidies. And it's quite troubling that if that's on the lower end of the spectrum of the effects, just how severe it is on the other side. I always thought the city would broadly be okay. I mean, I remember when I was writing the book, it was just like, if anything, it will bleed out. It's not going to have a heart attack, but you're going to lose sort of 10% capacity at the start. but these guys have loads of money. So, you know, in the long term, the one thing they can do is just sort of work their way around these various ways just to make sure that they stay at the position that they are. And of course, the city is rather protected by the fact that there really are no other centres in Europe that can take on the full capacity in terms of even housing or schooling of the kind of workers that you'd need in order to run it. So it always feels like they have an insurance policy there that, you know, agriculture most certainly does not. I mean, there has no insurance policy at all.
And before we all rush to the Isle of Scilly, everyone has a minus, right? There's nobody who's actually, there's no area that's actually getting better off in the short term.
Fishing must be a plus, no? When they
do it's better. A plus, but it's not enough of a plus to, and actually there's relatively few people employed in fishing, you've got to remember. I think it's about 30,000 in the UK, not a lot, in what they call the fish and seafood industry in Dex EU. and so overall, and they don't, you know, they don't tend to earn a lot either, sadly. So that's really why it doesn't have that big an impact overall, even in the Isles of Scilly, and that's one of the reasons why the Isles of Scilly does relatively well. Mm. Plus, you know, we will be staycationing.
Lawyers, accountants, journalists, they all do okay. People with FTSE 100 shares. I mean, these are basically, those are the some
the,
reason.
The most popular people in Britain.
Yeah.
Oh, you forgot the estate agents. You forgot the estate agents.
They really knocked the establishment on its arse here. I think they've done terribly well.
Yeah, just add serial killers and it's like a full house, isn't it? Britain's favourite people.
Okay, shall we have a quick commercial break? Politics is all well and good, but sometimes you need a change of pace. If you like music, films, books and TV, may we recommend you try our sibling podcast, as I always insist on calling it, Big Mouth, the smart pop culture talk show. Every week, Big Mouth brings together the best music, film and TV journalists in Britain to talk about what's coming out and what matters, including our very own Dorian Lynskey every now and again. So that's another reason to tune in. If you're looking for something to put on your phone for your holidays...
Maybe to be sarcastic.
No, wasn't being sarcastic at all. No, if you're looking for something to put on your phone for your holidays, recent episodes have covered everything from Game of Thrones and Spider-Man Homecoming to Father John Misty, Radiohead and The Handmaid's Tale. You can find every episode of Big Mouth at audioboom.com/channel/Big Mouth. It'll make you forget Liam Fox and David Davis, especially that sex scene, for a whole 45 minutes at a time.
Okay, last week we announced an exciting and possibly unwise experiment, Ask Romaniacs, where you, the listener, get to put your questions to our panel. We're not quite set up for a phone-in yet, so we asked listeners to tweet us with the hashtag AskRomaniacs, and we're going to try a few now. Ian, here's one for you. Totoro, of my neighbour Totoro fame, says, "This government has a hope of hell of doing Brexit to time and budget. Was there a past government who could have done it, or even got close?"
No. The key there is time. I mean... Any government could do it given enough time. I mean, anyone could do anything given enough time. But if you had a realistic timescale and decent negotiating capacity, this is doable. It's not intrinsic to Brexit that the whole thing has to be catastrophic. It's working to an unrealistic timescale without enough negotiating capacity. There would have been many previous governments that would not have got into the position where they would be approaching a problem in an unrealistic timescale without enough negotiating capacity. And I'd say that would go for almost any government that's taken place until now. No matter how much you may have disliked it, there was always a sense of responsibility that came from those roles that meant they just wouldn't have gotten into this mess. But in all of these cases, you know, the extent of it, you know, when we talk about things like your atom and all that, when we look at all these various bits of society that are affected by it, you see that the breadth and the depth of the problem, you can't do that in any less than 7 years after having really bulked up the people that you have in order to take it on. Of course, the real danger is when you just get civil servants and throw some trade law at them and go scrub up on this, they're going to get eaten alive in those rooms. That's why you don't send them in there until you've got seasoned veterans of trade disputes who can go in there and hold their own against these people, really specialist areas. So the answer is absolutely not, but all of those governments would have probably done more to make sure that they could.
Right. Roz, how about this one? Manu from Belgium asks, was there an inevitability to Brexit, given long-standing tensions in British politics? Not a question of if, but when.
No, there wasn't at all.
So that's that, Manu from Belgium.
Do you want me to go?
Please.
Okay, no, that's fine. Brexit happened because there was a referendum. There never needed to be a referendum. There was a referendum because David Cameron was very worried that his MPs would quit and join UKIP. If you remember, two of his MPs joined UKIP. And are they there now? Well, no, they're not. He basically, like so many Tory leaders, was felled by the Europe problem. But he mishandled it and he caved in much too quickly. And basically it was as soon as the Brexiteers started feeling they'd got something, you know, they got the renegotiation, they got promise of referendum, they just went for more and more and more, and they kept pushing it so that Euroscepticism became more and more mainstream. And by the time of the referendum campaign, it was sufficiently mainstream to get the hearing that it needed from the media. And that was how Brexit happened. You know, Euroscepticism used to be a very, very small pastime, enjoyed by a very, very few people, often in a very private way. And among
and
fellow...
And good luck to them.
And good luck to them. And it went mainstream, but it didn't have to. It went mainstream because of a series of bad choices on the part of David Cameron. And it also happened because of Boris Johnson and his decision. And Boris could have gone either way. You know, when he was deciding whether to back Brexit or not... Tim Shipman's recent book on Brexit is very good on this. He basically didn't think about Brexit itself. That wasn't what was motivating him. He sat down, he had big talks with Michael Gove about whether it was best to stay with Cameron or break free. And he decided that he was going to go with the Gove wing and he was going to cut himself off from Cameron and take that risk. That was what his choice to back Brexit was based on. And so that was, again, Boris's invention. Meant Euroscepticism, Brexit went mainstream. So no, it was never.
Because when we talk about long-standing tensions, obviously there are lots of long-standing tensions that were brought to a head with this, mm-hmm. but they didn't have to come to a head with a referendum on Europe, I think, yeah. a lot, because so many reasons people were voting to leave was not specifically about Europe. It was about immigration, it was about globalisation, it was about, you know, economic hardship in particular areas of the country. It was, you know, a lot of emotional and psychological stuff. And the idea that this could only have culminated in a referendum on the EU.
Yeah.
I don't buy. Those things would still exist, but they would manifest in other ways.
They would, and give people a referendum and give people a vote. They don't get a vote that often, even now, and they will vote against the mainstream in the government if they're fed up with the mainstream in the government. And that's what happened.
Yeah, because the referendum, but the question might as well have been, are you happy with how everything's going, or would you like to change?
Yeah.
You know,
and that simple yes, no as well, which may... Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
This is one for everyone. Roland Dunn asks, with only 18 months until the end of Article 50 and no sign of a deal, when might you start stockpiling baked beans, cash, petrol? I like his priorities there. Beans first. Sort out the beans.
I think it's also, what should we be stockpiling? I'd say French beans and euros, because they're going to go up in value, basically. Yeah.
Definitely not baked beans. I can't stand baked beans. Actually, for my kids, well, no, I wouldn't bake, because they're produced in Britain. You know, the biggest centre for baked bean production is it's up in the north, isn't it? It's between Liverpool and Manchester. Big, big baked bean production up there. So we're going to be fine for baked beans. Don't worry about baked beans.
I think that was the nub of his question, was the beans. I mean, should we start stockpiling anything? When do we feel that these kind of... the economic effects are really going to bite.
Well, Theresa May herself is stockpiling one thing, which is holidays in Europe. She's just gone there while she still can. And as the airlines keep pointing out, we really do have to reach a deal on Brexit Day, unless there is a transition that includes staying in the European aviation area and being subject to the ECJ. So that's one thing you can stockpile and get your holidays in now.
But the exchange rate is pretty ugly already.
And it's grotesque.
Promise of
getting any better. It's like a pound to a euro.
Yeah, it's probably horrible weather. I mean, apart from all the lovely ham and cheese and wine, of course, but nevertheless, it all costs more. There's different parts of the economy that get to a problem stage at different stages, right? So like in aviation, it's basically a year before. That's when they start sorting this stuff out. And that's why you're already starting to hear those noises around aviation. For other parts of the economy, it'll be slightly different. But there is that, when you talk to business guys, you really get that sense of, they just didn't really believe it was really happening before. I think really before the election, they were just like, someone's going to step in and stop all of this crazy stuff they're talking about. And then there was a real realization of, actually, you know what? No one's actually in charge here. No one's taking any charge, not around the cabinet table, not in Parliament, not in the Labour Party, certainly not in the Brexit department. And so I think now those guys are starting to prepare for the worst. And that'll really be that sort of 6 months leading up to it. The trouble is, by that stage, we're into the votes section. You know, according to Europe, there'll be no more talks once we're into those last 6 months of the negotiation. So really, it's very, very hard to tell. And of course, all of that takes place with the backdrop of how is sterling performing? What is inflation like? I mean, inflation figures were actually slightly improved last time. So that could offer a little bit of breathing space in how this goes. But that will set the context by which each industry, as it comes into its crunch timetables ahead of that deadline, start to feel the brunt of it.
Peter, can you be clever? I mean, is this going to be possible? This is just off the wall. What if I bought loads of a currency that the pound is still relatively strong against, and then I kept that, and then I bought euros with that later? Is that a strategy I should adopt?
Well, there's many ruined financiers and even local councils who've tried doing stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, that
yeah.
Basically you have to be sure that the market will move in the direction you think it will. And one thing, if there's one market, it's currencies, that is totally unpredictable. You might ask Norman Lamont about that at some point.
Okay. I'll hedge my limited bets. Yeah.
It's back to lottery tickets for you. Peter, here's one for you. Andrew Brown asks, which sectors will profit from Brexit? He suggests lawyers, immigration and emigration, consultants, people smugglers. Who else?
Well, podcasters, of course, and people who run blogs about Brexit. I mean, it's great to hear that the LSE is going to be financing the LSE Brexit blog for another couple of years. So the punditry industry is going to do well. If it's a very messy Brexit and there's no flights to and from Europe, I'd try to buy shares in Butlins, except that it's not quoted. But there is, you know, the people who own Madame Tussauds and so on, there'll be some very domestically focused businesses that have that face competition from Europe. In the case of these, it's European Holidays that will do well. But it's very, very hard to predict, because as we found it when discussing that paper on who's going to be winners and relative winners and losers from Brexit, it really depends on the second order and third order and fourth order effects. What happens to the pound? What happens behind that to interest rates compared with the interest rates in the euro area and the dollar area and so on? Very difficult to know. And then we will do those trade deals. And in order to get the trade deals with Brazil and the United States and India and so on, we will have to make concessions. Those concessions will be to let their very competitive industries in a particular area get into Britain, and that therefore may well, those companies that thought they'd got the European competition off their back will have the Brazilian, the Indian, the American and the Indonesian competition on their back.
But if the people who do well, I mean, presumably the tourist industry, the domestic tourist industry with a weak pound, we've already seen that, right? They get the benefit, they get European tourists and from elsewhere around the world coming in, and you've got more people staying at home, camping in the rain, as I've seen our regular producer Matt is doing today. So yep, presumably they're winners.
They should be, certainly, provided, you know, the economy doesn't go so bad that incomes, you know, suffer, and therefore, you know, you don't get the domestic market going on. If you think about it, people don't go on one holiday these days. They go on, especially if you've got children, you go on several short trips every time there's a school holiday, and therefore, if they haven't got the money to go to Alton Towers or Madame Tussauds or whatever, even with a few more foreign tourists, which tend to concentrate in London, you might not do better.
Ali Quack says, besides the tweeting we're doing in our little bubbles, is there anything positive we can do to bring about a Remain reality?
I've got an answer for this. The Queen wore that hat in the shape of the EU flag when she opened Parliament. In the Proms the other day at Royal Albert Hall, when they were playing the last movement of Beethoven's Ninth, alias the Ode to Joy, alias the EU anthem, there were people waving EU flags. The point is that, you know, we can keep reminding ourselves, as much as the Brexiteers, that we're 48% and rising. We are here. Europe is still here. We still want to be part of it. Just yep. To sort of not let the narrative settle that it's all fixed now, it's all closed.
Well, this is the thing, because you think, what is the main narrative that you're hearing again and again and again from Brexiteers? Which is just like, stop moaning, shut up, accept it, it's democracy, move on. And you think, if that's the thing you're constantly being told, that's the thing you should not do. And, you know, when people talk about a little bubble, it's like, I don't think it's that little a bubble, 48% of readers. It's not like, it's not that tiny.
So, I mean, if you look at the British Social Attitude Survey findings recently about showing the way that Remainers really did seem to dictate the way that that election went by throwing their lot in with Labour, which may or may not have been a sensible move. But you can see why people reached that conclusion. The bubble is not that small. But also, isn't the problem with that question in the question, which is, you've got to get out of that bubble. You've really just got to do it. And it doesn't matter whether you've got 5 followers on Twitter or whether you're just talking to Facebook or whether you're doing it at work. We have this thing of resisting getting into those discussions. There is a way of doing that while being polite and being decent and not getting too irate. And I know it can be difficult to like to not allow your emotions to be carried away and to not feel like, you know, you're being pulverized all the time. But if someone is out there making actual arguments, not being abusive and not going to that really safe, sarcastic space where nothing really matters and all of that kind of stuff. If they're out there making arguments, make the argument back and keep on holding people to account on this stuff, on the details of what they're saying, on the logic of what they're saying. So when we stop doing that and we start talking to ourselves, that we're in trouble. I'm aware of the name of this podcast and the room that we're sitting in, and our entire editorial proposition doesn't necessarily match up to that. But that is, you know, this
but
is
I'm sure
to be...
that many of our listeners are Leave voters sitting there thinking, going, oh, make you think.
Undoubtedly. Yeah. I'm sure we have a huge Leave contingent. But, you know, part of when we set up this podcast was about giving us a place to sort of recharge and to feel like you're not going completely mad. So you think, well, actually, I'm not the only person that is thinking this stuff. It doesn't mean you stay in that kind of bubble all the time. It means that that's where you go to, you know, to give yourself a hug and then go back out.
Well, there's kind of an analogy with protest songs, where a lot of the critique of protest songs is like, well, aren't you just preaching to the converted? You're not going to change anyone's mind, etc., etc. Largely, that may be true, but their enormous value is a sense of kind of solidarity and strength and sort of shared conviction among those who do agree. And it's not always about, I think there's a great kind of myth that all sort of political activity and discussion is always about changing the minds of the other side. And I think particularly in such a polarized debate, obviously you would love to do that, but it's not the only game in town.
There's an analogy with a particular social movement. It's to be out and to be proud and to make it clear that there are more of us than you think.
Yeah, and the great thing is as well that it's not a great thing, but whether you're a natural Tory supporter or a natural Labour supporter, or whether you're something else, it's kind of gone beyond party politics now if you're a Remainer, because, let's face it, the Lib Dems are not in a strong position. So you don't have to sort of follow the party line, and you don't have to be involved in party politics to be involved in talking about Brexit. It's kind of transcended that, and it's gone beyond it. And that's actually quite liberating. As someone who's always, you know, never wanted to be put into a party box and has always resisted that, I find it quite liberating to be able to have a subject which transcends these boundaries.
Yeah, that's interesting. Although you can really feel it rubbing up, can't you? Like, I mean, when you look at the people who have real convictions for Remain and those who have real convictions for Jeremy Corbyn, you can almost see them just starting to just fall apart out there. Which of these things are they going to be able to...
You can see that some of the Corbynites, you know, like Matt Zarb, cousin, wrote a piece yesterday, I think, and the real position of most Corbynites is neither pro nor anti. It's they just don't really care. That was basically what he was saying. It's like, I don't care. I want Labour in for the following reasons, and he wouldn't come out and say it, but that was kind of the underlying message.
There is that, but there's is also a strand in Labour thinking which is kind of partly a Corbynite strain, and because he is not a Remainer, which is that after Brexit things will get really bad, and we know what happens when people things get really bad. Governments
Fascism.
Get thrown out. Well, governments get thrown out, other governments get voted in. And in that sense, Brexit is an opportunity. The worse Brexit goes, let's face it, the easier it will be for Labour to win the next election. And that is why they are staying quiet. And also, you know, it gives the government more leeway and more power to do what it wants if it Labour what they want if they get into power. So that is the other thing that's preoccupying.
Well, as Homer Simpson said, the Chinese have the same word for crisis as opportunity, crisitunity.
Yeah.
And this is Labour's crisitunity.
Disaster socialism is another way of putting it, yeah.
And finally, Jake Staines asks, why is your theme tune that awful aggressive strings thing and not Ode to Joy? It's not its official title, that awful aggressive strings thing. Now, Ode to Joy is a bit of a cliche, but it's funny you should bring that up. We may well have some interesting news on the music front very soon. And on that cryptic note, we're coming to the end of the show. Thanks to Roz Taylor for returning to Romaniacs. Please come back soon. Third time's a charm. Where can listeners read the LSE Brexit blogs?
Well, the simplest thing would be to just Google LSE Brexit blog. But if you want the full URL...
On a computer?
On a computer, or use another search engine
Google.
If you prefer
com?
It. Use another search engine if you don't approve of Google. Yeah.
And we'll be posting a link to that fascinating feature about regional variation on our Facebook page.
Great.
Thanks to our co-hosts Peter Collins and Ian Dunt. Remember, you can hear more Romaniacs and find all our social media connections at romaniacs.com. We'll be back next week doing our best to ensure that British sovereignty stays where it belongs, in Brussels. Until then, we're going to finish with a reason to be cheerful. And it's Roz's turn. What have you got for us?
Well, I've got two this week. I'll just make them brief, though. Number one, the fact that Theresa May is in Switzerland. Now, I would normally have said this a year or so ago, but let's face it, Switzerland has a reasonably good deal. It has, it is in the single market, but it is not in the EEA. Now, it all gets very complicated about what we choose to join, but it may be that she is, while she is in Switzerland, she thinks, yes, this is a model that we could follow. I might not have to have such a hard Brexit after all. It has freedom of movement as well, by the way. The other thing is Boris Johnson. Now, I don't want to sound like, you know, I'm obsessed with Boris, but Boris, it was reported this week, and it was reported falsely, according to Boris himself, was thinking about resigning as Foreign Secretary. That's what Vince Cable said. Boris said that was rubbish. But I reckon Boris is wavering. Boris is in a very interesting position right now, and I think he has a lot of power, potentially, to change people's minds. If he decided that it was time to come up and make a speech, he could start, if it was really tasteless, he could start it, "I had a dream," about Brexit and how great it was going to be, if it was really tasteless. And he could make an enormous splash saying that he had thought about it and, you know, those Johnny Foreigners were making it so difficult for us. Frankly, it was going to be easy to stay. And one thing Boris never likes to do is flog a dead horse. I say leave a dead horse where it is, so on and so forth. And he might actually change minds. I reckon that there's a possibility, 1 in 10, that he might be thinking about doing that. But that is a hunch.
Boris Johnson being tasteless, I can't imagine that at all.
We know he has, you know.
It was amazing, wasn't it, how quickly his office came out with that he's not resigning thing. You just thought, wow, that actually spooked you. And that did make me happy. Just to think, really, that he had panicked moments of sweaty, induced nightmares in bed late at night.
Mm, and I hope he's suffering.
And that's us done. We'll see you next week. Until then, it's the turn of Italy. Non lasciate che I bastardi vi macinino Gio.
Romaniacs was presented by Doreen Linsky with Peter Collins, Ross Taylor and Ian Dunt. The programme editor was me, Andrew Harrison, and production was by Elliot Prince. Romaniacs is a Podmasters production.